I had occasion last week to visit New York City. I brought with me on the trip a volume of the Book of Job to refresh myself in its pages in preparation for this morning. On the desk in the hotel room, I found a copy of the small monthly magazine Guideposts, and this coincidence suggested some of the thoughts which I should like to share with you this morning. Guideposts is a well-conceived religious magazine published by Dr. Norman Vincent Peale. Dr. Peale is pastor of the Marblegate Collegiate Church in New York City. He is an orator of acclaim. He is certainly the most popular of all of the current churchmen authors. His book, The Power of Positive Thinking, has sold over 1 million copies since it was published some 5 years ago. Dr. Peale preaches an earthy and an optimistic gospel. It might be symbolized by his oft-repeated motto, faith power can work miracles. Dr. Peale feels that faith and prayer are an especially health-giving antidote for the poisons of frustration and depression and lonesomeness which enter into and wreak such havoc with the human soul. Dr. Peale makes much of the emotional disturbance, distraughtness, the malaise of our age. He points to the alarming rate at which mental breakdown is increasing. He underscores the excessive use of tranquilizers by our people. He says that a people who lives amidst as much plenty as ours ought to be developing a literature of enthusiasm, of happiness. But turn, he says, to our stage, to the popular novel, and you'll find that it chronicles a society deeply disturbed and distracted. As a remedy, he proposes the medicine of faith. Where he says that faith renews a man's confidence. Faith refreshes a man and prepares him anew for life's struggles. Faith releases in man many of his latent capacities and prepares him better for achievement in life. The magazine Guideposts is a magazine of testimony. It contains the spiritual biographies of men and women who have accepted Dr. Peale's medicine and who have found that in faith and in prayer, their lives have developed a new dimension. Through faith and prayer, they have become happier and more successful men and women. In the issue of Guideposts through which I browsed, there was the chronicle of a shy, diffident woman who through faith found a means of projecting her personality and of winning for herself the social approval of her friends. There was a story of a football team who through prayer, group prayer, found a way to victory and also to a deeper meaning of the group spirit and of the meaning of sportsmanship. And there was finally the biography of a businessman who had been hobbled by feelings of inadequacy and who found that prayer and faith gave him a new confidence and permitted him to succeed in business and hence to support his family and his wife in a way which previously he'd been unable to achieve. Now, I have no quarrel with Dr. Peale's enthusiasm for faith. I, too, believe that our age badly needs spiritual values and spiritual ideals. I too agree with Dr. Peale that faith can work wonders with our inner lives. It can help us to find a much needed sense of perspective amidst the thousand forces and obstacles which impinge upon our daily life. Faith can give us that much needed sense of purpose, which gives meaning color to our lives. But somehow I feel that Dr. Peel's enthusiasm for faith knows no limits, no bounds. He speaks in one breath of faith as spirit medicine and of the rewards which faith brings in the physical world, the tangible rewards which faith brings to man. Consider his formula, and I quote, "Hard work, positive thinking, right living, the proper treatment of other human beings, and the proper kind of prayer always get results." And if you take the results which he considers from the testimony of his magazine Guidepost, then these are results of a very tangible physical nature. A woman who achieves social acceptance, a football team which achieves a skein of victories, a businessman who achieves success in his chosen enterprise. I simply cannot accept such an optimistic view of the results of faith. I do not feel that it conforms with the reality of the world as it exists. I said that I had brought with me to New York the book of Job. And as I browsed through the biographies and the testimonies of the Guidepost magazine, I thought often of the testimony of the book of Job. Job was a man of deep and solid faith. Job was a good man. God himself says of Job that there was none like him in the earth as righteous, a man who feared God and shunned the evil. Job was a man who worked diligently. Job was a man who thought positively. Job was a man who prayed with his whole heart. And as a result, in a single day, bandits made off with Job's cattle. Lightning ignited a fire which destroyed Job's barns and his sheep and killed his servants. Chaldean robbers attacked his caravans and pillaged and decimated them. And a howling tornado leveled the house in which his children were eating and meeting and brought them to an untimely death. And when Job persisted in his faith, and when Job determined to continue to live by the standards of righteousness and justice, when Job refused to blaspheme God or to revert to some less noble form of action, as a result, Job himself was afflicted with disease. The racking pain of some dreaded skin ailment coursed through his body and no longer allowed him a moment of respite or relief. This was the reward which Job received for hard work, for positive thinking, for right living. Now, of course, Job is a book of fiction. There is no earthly counterpart to the anguish to which Job had to submit, as there is no earthly cause for the troubles which Job underwent. God and a doubting Thomas angel were arguing in heaven concerning the nature of man. God had a high opinion of us. He felt that we were capable of noble acts, of acts of disinterested service. Not so the doubting angel. He felt that no man acted but out of self-interest. And when man did that which seemed proper and seemed to be the right, he did so only to win the approval of his society, because he felt that he would gain thereby. God did not argue in theory with this angel. Instead, he offered him a living example, the paragon of nobility in his age, Job. "Look at my servant Job. Is he not a man of fully noble spirit? Is he not a man of courage, of uprightness, of deep faith? Surely the example of such a man will, O angel, give you a much better and much more hopeful evaluation and estimate of human nature. But the angel scoffed. The angel chided God. How is Job in any way a proof of your contention? Have you not built a hedge around Job? Has he not been blessed with position, with wealth, with fame, with family, with love? Has his courage and his faith ever been tried? Has his character ever been put to the test? Job is put to the test. Job is made to suffer all these many anguishes in order to vindicate God's judgment of men. And so his troubles are literary fiction. But as is so often the case in great literary works, there is a good deal of real truth hidden in this fiction. For the book of Job teaches us that God has never promised man any quid pro quo for good conduct. Life is not a schoolroom in which at the end of the term, the good scholar and the diligent student is rewarded with praises and with prizes. God has never signed with any of us a promissory note guaranteeing the bearer his heart's desire in return for rectitude and probity and allegiance. We might wish that it were so, but the world is not of our making. The book of Job underscores the inscrutability of life. Life is not a predetermined movement from birth to grave through comfortable and predictable stages. The road of life is filled with sudden detours, with rough road, with obstacles, with bypaths, with detours. There is a tragic element to life which from time to time intrudes upon the happy routine of our existence. But what is tragedy? But the intrusion upon, the unexpected intrusion of unhappiness, of sorrow, and of loss, and of grief upon the normal day-to-day activity of man. Look closely even at this comfortable antiseptic world in which we live. And you will see that there is hardly a home and hardly a family which does not bear the scars of the tragic element of life. Here a young mother nurses a child who will never walk. Here a young widow draws close about her the mantle of memory, walking lonesomely through life, warmed only by the dim fire of love. Here a father carries on bravely, though his son left his house full of youth, strength, but will never there return. I need not recite to you examples of the sad litany of tragedy. I wish only to underscore, as Job sought to underscore, that life has this tragic element. We ought not to look at life only through rose-colored glasses and to assume and to presume that each day will be a happier occasion, a more joyful opportunity than the last. It will simply not be so. When we least expect it, when we are least prepared, tragedy walks in the door. Hard work, my friends. Hard work and right living and positive thinking always bring results except when death intrudes itself between the promise and the fulfillment. Hard work, positive thinking, proper prayer always bring results except when someone better placed, abler than we, seeks the same goal as we covet. What I am saying and what Job was saying is simply this, that though it may not matter the cut and style of the garment of faith that we draw around us when the sun of good fortune shines, It matters greatly the cut and style of the garment of faith which we draw around us when the first ill winds of misfortune blow and howl about us. For the fragile summer garments, the garments of the man who expects God to reward him for his good conduct, will be plucked off his back, decimated by the howling winter winds of pain and loss. And at the very moment when man most needs the serene comfort of faith, instead of serenity, his mind will be filled with doubt. Instead of comfort, his soul will be filled with bitterness. For God will have let this man down. God will have reneged on his promise. Where there ought to be consoling and encouragement and renewed strength, there will be only a vague flaying of the fists against an unheeding heaven. Only the bitterness of frustration. God will not have lived up to a promise which he never made. And the faith of such a man will not be equal to the demands which tragedy places upon it. When we are faced with death, when we are faced with bitter illness, when we are faced with any of the tragic elements in life, whatever faith we claim is sorely tried. Only if we have long since been prepared to view our faith honestly, only if we have achieved a true perspective on our faith, has our faith any hope of surviving the challenge of that hour. Job had such a faith. Job, long before the day of his anguish, knew that when God's blessing shone upon him, it was not because of his sterling character. And when God's ill temper, if you will, turned against him, it was not because of any lack on his part. When Job's wife, overwhelmed with her grief, distraught, unnerved, turns to Job and cries out to him, "Curse God and die," what does Job answer? "Thou speakest as one of the impious women. What, shall we not receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not expect also to receive evil?" Job had long since known that there will be in life the twilight as well as the dawning, that the summer sun of good fortune will be replaced by the brutal snows of winter. The Lord has given, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. The book of Job then teaches us many things. It teaches us that we ought not to see life only in its hopeful colors. We must see life in all of its parts. It teaches us that we ought not to look on good conduct as a means for achieving for ourselves success or fame or fortune. That often in life, the good man must suffer and the wicked man seems to prosper. Is there then no reward for good living, for good conduct, for faith in God? Paradoxically, Job, who most denies this thesis, most affirms it. When Job was overwhelmed with his grief, three of his familiar friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, came to console him. For the 7 days of mourning, they sat beside him in silent companionship, extending the unspoken word of sympathy which means so much in the hour of loss. And when the 7 days of mourning were over, These three good friends of Job tried to console him and to comfort him by explaining the meaning of his suffering, by encouraging him to feel that his suffering would be only for the hour, that in time God, his Redeemer, would come. These men, brilliant poetic dialogue, examined the whole philosophy of human suffering. And they tried to emphasize to Job that no man is perfect, and that God sometimes punishes even the good man in order to give that man pause, to make him remember that there is always room for improvement. But that when you look at the scheme of history in time, the high living of the wicked is only the preamble to their fall, and the defeat of the good is but the preamble to their triumph. Job, strangely, would have none of this comfort. Even though these men promised him the ultimate redemption of God, Job denies consistently in the dialogues their essential prime thesis. He refuses to admit that his fate was in any way dependent upon his actions. And certainly he denies that the vast, overwhelming trouble and anguish to which he had to submit is in any way commensurate with weakness or wickedness on his part. Job simply refuses to admit that there is any balance in life between perfidy and punishment, between service of God and success in living. This Job will not admit. But what then? Does this mean that it is a foolish virtue to continue to struggle to do the right? Might not the cheating way be better than the honest way? Might not the self-interested way through life be better than the selfless way? For if God is unheeding, and if there is no reward in life for our good deeds, why then should we penalize ourselves through charity, through graciousness, through gentleness, when we might be feathering our own nest through determined, selfish concern with our future? Job refuses to admit this philosophy, which many of the hero philosophers of mankind have espoused. Job prefers to think that the right is worth the doing simply because it is the right. Job prefers to remind us that the reward of the good deed is the good deed itself. That we must not look in the physical world about us, in the world of things, for the reward of man, that we must look in the inner world inside us, the world of emotions, of conscience, and of character. That if we look into this world, we will see and we will understand the reward of goodness. The reward of the good deed, Job says, is the assurance which we develop that we have been worthwhile sons of God. The reward of the good deed is the peace of mind that we achieve when we are conscious that we have lived by manly, decent standards, that we have acted with kindliness and with gentleness towards our neighbors, that we have in all ways comported ourselves as human beings. The reward of the good deed is the inner peace, the inner self-assurance which we develop when we are conscious of having done the noble deed, the valiant achievement, that we have lived not as animals but as sons of God. We have lived up to the best, the highest potential that we possess. In short, the reward of the good deed is our own sense of personal worthwhileness. Job says as much. I will hold fast to my innocence. I will not deny it. My conscience has no regrets all of my life. And when our conscience has no regrets, when we have assured ourselves, and we are the hardest judges of this, when we have assured ourselves that our lives have been noble lives, worthwhile lives, that we have done all that it was in our power to do for others, for our God, then it matters little whether we live amidst the richness of the earth or in much simpler surroundings. It matters little whether we enjoy the fullness of health or must struggle against the debility of illness. We will have found the secret of true happiness, a happiness, a sense of inner peace which will be ours whatever the wheel of fortune decrees for our lives. It will accompany us in good times, it will shield us and encourage us in bad times, it will be ours always. This then is the burden of Job. He teaches us to look with candor and with honesty at life, not to expect of life a continuing round of pleasure and of joy, but to remember that man who is born of woman is few of days, full of troubles. He blooms as the flower, but he withers. He flees as the shadow. He continues not. Job asks us to build our faith on an honest estimation of the reality of the world in which we live. Job reminds us not to expect God to return us any dividend for right living or for faith. That dividend will be ours in the world within, because we will have held fast to our innocence, because our conscience will not reproach us all of our days. Amen.